thank you, Noel, for the invitation, and it's lovely to be with a bunch of guys that we can talk about something that's so fundamental to us is our sense of faith and our sense of the creation. So thank you to the cooks. I really enjoyed my breakfast. It was really good, and it's nice to be here in Cooma. You probably know I was born in Tumbarumba, so I'm sort of in the snowy region, I suppose, a long time ago. I had a beaut time recently back there snowy at Tumba with my son at a camp drafting event, which was quite something, but it was good to be back and see all the old country again. What I want to talk about this morning is really, I've called it our land, sacred, bountiful, bleeding, frightening, yet friends. I want to sort of talk about my sense as a scientist, how we relate to the creation that God has put us in. Because most of you, and I've given you a little handout, and you can look at the pictures as I go, rather than I didn't use PowerPoint, because I'd rather talk to people directly. There's a place for PowerPoint, but not this morning. So when we look at the little pictures I've given you, when we are thinking and feeling about the land that you folks are all part of, there seems to be at least five ways we react to the land. The first one is the sacred sense, that I think we've all had moments of experience where we sense that this is sacred. This is where God, we can sense the presence of God in the creation. Now, I've used a couple of pictures there of Uluru and other rocks, but I had a lovely moment at the lookout just out of Cooma yesterday afternoon. Just sitting and looking across that landscape, it has a sacredness about it. And of course our Indigenous people probably can feel that from their 60,000 years more strongly than I as a five generation Australian, but I still sense the something of the same, and I've shared it with our Indigenous people that the feelings of the sacredness is there, and it's in all of us. But it's not the only way we look at the landscape and the thing. The other way, we all know as a farmer's son that it's bountiful, and there's a picture there of my sunspot at Yass, and the bountiful nature and the picture beneath of the rhodobales. So the land is a very sacred thing, but it's also bountiful. But it's also, I've used the word bleeding. We also know, and Noel and other people on the land can see, that we don't always look after it well. And in some ways, the biggest challenge in why I'm a scientist, I suppose, and an ag scientist originally, was that I was challenged by my father sometimes. He hated seeing the country knocked about, because it was during the rabbit plagues of the 50s and the time that I grew up, and soil erosion. And I remember talking with Dad as we put a big yield of wool off, something like 500 bales, which is a lot of wool in those days. And I said, that was a good year, Dad. And he said, well, yes, John, it was, but I wish I could do it and do less damage to God's creation. And that's been a strong motivation for me as a scientist, is the sense of how do we grow the bounty and the food and the fibre we need as people in the creation and look after the creation. Trying to find agriculture and food and fibre means of production that don't do those pictures, those four top pictures that you see there. And whether it's agriculture or mining, we certainly leave our landscape bleeding. But the other way the Australian landscape to me has impacted on me, and I think you'll probably agree, is that it also can be frightening. The terror of the fires, the terror of the flood, the terror of the drought, the frightening loss of life due to being out in the desert and running out of water. It's a frightening thing. I used to work in North Queensland a lot out around Julia Creek and Ewenden, and we were always so careful to make sure we had water whenever we went out. I was soil sampling or walking through the bush making measurements and things, and a lot of the blokes I worked with didn't have the rural background that I had, so they were not very careful. And sometimes they'd go off without water. I wouldn't go anywhere without water. We used to use water bags in those days. But nevertheless, they're very good. But I remember coming across a family who'd strayed off the road and had no water. And yet they had a radiator full of it, you know, in the car. But, you know, we managed to... Just the frightening nature of being in the bush, being lost in the bush, being lost in the thing without. And there's a few pictures from our different artists there of the frightening nature of the Australian landscape. But one of the things that's really important that's happening now is a colleague of mine, and I think you know, Noel, you know Chris Dalton, don't you? Well, Chris Dalton did his PhD, and I was fortunately one of his supervisors and examiners. And he wrote where he actually looked at how we've moved from this terra nullis, that the Australian landscape is all those things, moved from the terra nullis picture to one of companion. And I think that's happening to us all as we've come to terms. It's probably taken us four generations or five generations as immigrants to actually get to see the landscape as our companion. And Chris Dalton has written that book called From Terra Nullis to Beloved Companion. If you're interested, it's a worthwhile read. You can get it at Amazon or any of the bookshops. And he's a Uniting Church minister who has really struggled with this issue. And I want to come to the substance in a minute. But you can see there's a picture of Wendy Martin's in the Broken Hill Museum. You can see on the top of page 3, there's a picture there of this person sitting, and you can see that the actual connection between her body and the actual landscape is though it is one. It's a beautiful piece of art. If you get to Broken Hill, it's worth having a look at that gallery and seeing it explores this fact that we are part of the creation in spirit and in truth. And of course the next little picture is a picture that I love, is not far from my home. They're looking across the Brindabellas from the Pinnacles, where I find that, yeah, this is where we are. So given all these senses of feelings with our land, how should we live? We see damage, the pressure of our presence, trying to find enough way to build food and fibre for 9 billion people. That's what the planet's struck with. So the land is both a sacred cow and, as Einstein said, also a milking cow. He always said that about science, that science is a sacred thing to understand the very nature of the creation. But also that creation is a milking cow. It's our sustenance. It can harm us, the creation. It can feed us, it can nurture us, and it can sustain us. But how, as people of faith in Jesus the Christ, do we see our calling? The creation, in my experience, is quite indifferent, if you look at it, to our well-being. Our well-being and the creation are quite independent. Some people feel that if as a scientist looking at it, the way the evolutionary process works, the way the landscape evolution works, the way the geology works, it's quite indifferent to our well-being. The way a river floods, the way an ocean roars, how it affects us is quite independent. In my experience, let me give you an example. If you have a volcano erupt and flow across the lava, basalts probably, flow across the landscape and forms a fertile river valley, we say that's a beautiful thing of God. But if that volcano happened to go through a village, how do we feel? It's the same volcano, it's the same lava flow. One has a beautiful valley created, the other one destroys us. So the actual processes, as a scientist, that I'm aware of and understand are quite independent and separate from our personal well-being. So if we accept that, we then have to see, okay, where's God in that? If God created the way the planetary system works, the way the evolution of the animal kingdom, the way the evolution of the landscape and its geology and its ocean forming and the land forming processes are indifferent to us, where does that leave us? We can still cling to the thing that God will intervene, and there's a place for that. But you know, the thing that really makes a difference to me is the Christmas story. Because that creation that we're living in, with all its richness, all its bounty, all its sacredness, is there, and the Christmas story says that God loves us and he came to be with us, living with us in that creation, sitting with us. A man who I've got had a wonderful time with in the bushfires at Cobargo recently, Brian Elliott. He's the head of the fire brigade there. And he went through hell. He happens to be a Christian, a member of the LL congregation there. And in the middle, as we talked about it, he described the pain and the fear that he knew. But he said, you know, John, in the midst of the ashes, I knew God was with me. God is the creator. But he takes responsibility, in my view, for that creation by sending his Son and Christ to be in the world with us right from the beginning. We're not alone. God is redeeming and renewing and ongoing with us in our spirit. And of course, in our traditional way, we say, yes, God comes and forgives and carries the price of that. He took responsibility for it. So God, Creator God, acts and speaks both within and beyond the creation. God cared so deeply for humanity that he became flesh and dwelt with us. I like the interpretation of the Greek to say he came and pitched his tent with us. He joined us. He knows our pain. He knows our joy. Just as Brian knew that he sat with us in those ashes, he cries with us. I know what it's like to lose a loved one like my wife, my first wife. You sit with the pain. But I sense that God cried and held me. He knew the pain that I felt. And I know that Keith's going through that now. And many of you probably, each one of you, will have that sense that in the pain, in the ashes, God sits and holds us. That's the nature of the creation that we are part of. I'm convinced that God cares deeply for all that God has created and continues to create. And we are part of that. And people say, well, what is the essence of the gospel to you as a scientist? And I say, certainly that God loves me and redeems me. But also God asks me to be part of the ongoing redemption of the creation and the caring for that creation. Because it is sacred, it is beautiful, it is bountiful, it's fearful, and God is with me in the midst of it. To make these reconnections, you can go to the Revelations in the New Creation or Colossians chapter 1. So as you turn across to page 4, we see more clearly God's concern for the reconciliation and the restoration of all creation is a fundamental part of the Christian gospel. There are some in Christendom who would argue that looking after the environment is an optional extra. It's a nice one, but it's not central to the gospel. Well, I think it's quite the opposite. I think that looking after and being part of and recognising the reconciliation of the creation is not an add-on extra. It's not a sideshow, but it's rather the gospel, it's the core. It's the bigger picture, the cosmic Christ. The redeeming of us personally is so important, as Lynn and I talked about. It's vitally important. But it's the redeeming of the whole creation also that's the Christ living with us. So engaging this truth ensures that we do have a story to lead us into the future. We go into the situation faced with the climate change issues, the pressures of feeding ourselves for 9 million people, the pressures of maintaining the richness and the biodiversity of God's creation. God is with us in all that. We are people of hope. We go into the environmental issues with God. It's the story of the ongoing creation, the cosmic Christ. Read John chapter 1. So that in the light of this deep gospel story, we need to rediscover it fully and affirm and live out this new story. We need to develop the story, a story that leads us to understand our place and how we might live in the ecosystems of the earth so that the whole creation might be reconciled and renewed. We need to pray, of course, but listen to God, ponder the scriptures and learn, and grow our new story. As Revelation says, a new song for the earth. The hope and assurance of what I'm trying to say is written simply for me in Colossians 1:19-20. For God was pleased to have all his fullness dwell in him, and through him to reconcile to himself all things, whether things on earth or things in heaven, by making peace through his blood shed on the cross. You can interpret all of that there. And you know, Arthur Boyd, he lived in the Shoalhaven, of course, and he painted that picture that you can see on the top of page 5 of the cross and the creation, where he sees that. And this is a piece of poetry that was written by Norman Havel. Violet announces Christ in our cosmos, holding our earth in all its pain. Christ now invites us, join in my mission, covenant with me to heal earth again. And this is what I'm trying to say about Christ in the landscape. Can you join me as I pose the question? Has our focus on the historical Jesus been such that we have neglected the post-resurrection Jesus who is alive and with us? We can live in the history and it's rich. But Jesus is about the resurrection and the recreation of all things new. That's the excitement. That's why I stand before you. It's good to know the history of Jesus, a story on earth. But it's the story of him with us now that makes life rich, sits with us when life hurts, rejoices with us when life is good. So, by not giving spiritual attention to the Christ, the post-resurrection Jesus, the Word, the Logos, the cosmic Christ, have we missed that it's so important in our time? We have missed what is so important in our time. The renewal and healing of the ecology and life support systems of the planet. The ongoing work of our loving God and Creator. Often when I talk with some of my young grandchildren, now they range from 25 down to 13, but there is a bit of a worry, and I know in the Uniting Church we're talking with young people who really fear for the future, for the issues of the climate that they know scientifically is occurring because they're well educated, but they see us fumbling the ball in knowing how to go forward. They tend to be fearful. And I think we have a very important message to say, no, not fearful. This is God with us, finding a way through the reconciliation. We must We see great hope, therefore, in that we can solve these issues and we can go forward with hope. And I see evidence of that. Well, that's my best effort to tell my story, but it's very much an unfinished story. And it's a story that I'm sure you'll work through in your own way. Can we who have grown up in a Christian family where the gospel ended with personal salvation and a cry for social justice possibly grasp a much larger and grander view of Jesus the Christ? My answer is, yes we can and yes we must. In that case, we can be a people of hope when faced with the huge ecological and climate change issues we face in living in a safe operating place on the planet. So that, as we go and conclude, if so, we can be assured that the post-resurrection Jesus will be the wind under our wings. The wind under our wings. That's the Isaiah sense of who Jesus was. Such a beautiful image Isaiah had of what Jesus was. And join in the words of Norman Havel. Violet announces Christ in our cosmos, holding our earth in all its pain. Christ now invites us, join in my mission, covenant with me, to heal earth again. Join me on the journey. I'm sure you already have. Can we just pray? Dear loving God, you are so big, and yet you touch us at our very core, and yet you hold us in the ashes and are the wind under our wings as we be your people in this place, the people of hope, because you came at Christmas and changed everything. Amen.